Hey, Tori.
Hi, Greg.
I have a question for you. There's a phrase that is not, it's not relevant to you yet, but I'm quite sure you've heard. You ever heard of a midlife crisis?
Of course.
Yeah. And we're not going to go into that today, thankfully. But I had never heard the term quarter life crisis until our guest today. And I was just really fascinated with the honesty and about the pressure of millennials when it comes to just all sorts of things. I mean, as a millennial, were you just kind of going, yeah, duh, this is what we, was any of this a surprise to you?
I wouldn't say it was a surprise to me. When I'm thinking about conversations I've had with friends and people I'm very close to that are also in this age bracket, there's this societal pressure that you have to have your life figured out by 30 years old or you're a failure.
Yeah, I've talked to your husband about this, where it's a mm-hmm. thing of, oh yeah, social media puts out the impression out there, particularly for your generation, of, hey, if I'm not a millionaire, if I haven't retired by the time I'm 30, you know, I missed my chance, which is yep. extraordinary to me that that kind of pressure builds on young shoulders that way. But I understand it. I trust that that is going on. And then when I go back and I look at some of the stuff that's flowing out there in, you know, in social media, just in our culture in general, it's like, oh yeah, you get that impression that you have to have had all of this figured out. So our guest today is Thane Marcus Ringler, and he's a former pro golfer who is now, I would call him an entrepreneur. He's a writer. He's a speaker. He's got a podcast called The Up and Comer Show. And it's really, he's talking real honestly and openly about in his life having to essentially retire at a very young age. And it made sense to me how he was having to wrestle with what I would call identity issues way earlier than I think a lot of people would imagine, because he had to let go of this career that he had been spending years to prepare for as a pro golfer.
Yeah, you hear you don't just wake up one day and become a professional athlete. I think we all know that, but him even talking about getting on the tour and kind of your rookie season versus making it, of there are years of you kind of grinding it out. And right as he's kind of hitting that stride, he has this injury that, like you mentioned, he's forced to retire. And so this huge career ahead of him with all of these years, it was a pretty abrupt closing of a door. And he talks about kind of the struggles of that, of having to, at a still young age, realize, so everything I've been working towards, that's not really on the table anymore. What do I do now?
Right. So here's what I would be thinking. If I were a millennial, I'd be going, ooh, okay, I'm listening. If I wasn't, like, say, a little bit older or maybe even a little bit younger, I'd be going, I don't know if this one is for me. Here's what I would say. I couldn't help but recall, as he was talking, all of the words that are being spoken and used around the idea of the great resignation these days. And we're in a cultural reset. But I was telling some of my friends and some coworkers that there's also, I have seen what, I don't know if anybody else is calling it this, but I've also seen what I would call the great retirement. Okay. And by that, I mean, people who are hitting the off ramp early, they're not checking out of the game. They're not checking out of, you know, hey, I want to get things done in this world. They're not saying I'm putting my feet up and you know, staring at the garden for the rest of my days, though there's nothing wrong with that. But these are people who are saying, I'm retiring from what I thought was going to be the thing. And lots of reasons why. But in this cultural reset, I was hearing some of what Thane was saying and going, you know what, it doesn't really matter how old you are. So many of us are going, okay, now what? What's next? And so I think there's a lot of relevant conversation from this young man. And I found myself going, oh, you know what? I need to listen to him. I mean, it's good to hear from somebody and to hear from another perspective about his journey and how he's doing this. So honestly, I think we should just jump in and listen in on this conversation that we had recently with Thane Marcus Ringler. Okay, Thane, we're really wanting to just learn a little bit about your story, and I'd just love to hear, just give us some context, your story. There's so many places I'd like to go and ask you, but just get us started.
Well, thanks for having me on, Greg. One of my favorite places to start is a quote from Bill Simmons, who said, "I was born on third base and thought I hit a triple." I think that's a great way to just preface my story by saying, I truly was born on third base. I was born into an upper middle class family in the middle of Kansas, small town USA, God loving family, raised in the church, given all the opportunities in the world. So I just want to caveat everything by saying I didn't get to choose any of that. You know, that was all given to me, and my role was to steward that well. And so that's been a large theme in my life. Growing up in Kansas was a great place. Ended up going out to college in California, Los Angeles, so quite the opposite of Hutchinson, Kansas. Played golf my whole life, which turned into collegiately and then professionally for about 4 years. God brought me out of golf into a new path, and that's really working with individuals and teams now and organizations on performance, taking some of that background with golf and competing, applying it to people in their work and in their lives. So that's kind of the short-winded snippet version, but that gives you some of the main points, at least along the way so far.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so you've already got some things that just questions that I would want to ask you, but one of them is, so you grew up in Kansas, Hutchinson, Kansas, is that right?
That's correct.
I'm going to act like I know a lot about this, but I played Prairie Dunes once, and it didn't go well, all right? But my guess is you're familiar with that course and all of those things, and we'll get into some of that. But this life in which you're living, so let's go back to the idea of golf. I'm sure you're not surprised by people wanting to say, okay, so tell me about that part of your journey. The reason I'm just tipping my hand here, though, I do want to get to kind of that transition out of golf into what you're doing now. But go on ahead and just, not everybody gets to kind of throw that out in their bio. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, you know, it's a really fun, sexy thing to throw out in a bio. It's not so fun and sexy to live out.
Exactly.
And yes. I think that's, you know, you can relate to that as a pastor and speaker and author, right? Those are all sexy things to throw around. The reality always looks a lot different on the inside looking out. And I think what's true in all those cases, that it takes an immense sacrifice. I think regardless of the path you choose, if you want to be a high performer, if you want to do it well, if you want to live with intentionality, the more you try to accomplish, the bigger the sacrifice it will take. In golf, definitely was true. You know, it takes on average 7 to 10 years for most guys to get their PGA Tour card. So that means for 7 to 10 years, the majority of guys that you see on the big screen on Sundays or on the weekend are guys who have slogged it out in the trenches for almost a decade. Right. And let me tell you, those trenches aren't very fun. You're on a shoestring budget. You're trying to save as much money as possible, staying in kind of dumpy places or in people's homes, in these small events throughout the country to earn experience, to earn money, to be able to capitalize in the midst of pressure when you have opportunities. Because that, like most things in life, golf is true in the sense that really it's all about getting breaks. But the difference is, you know, I think a CBS announcer, I can't remember which one, said it. He said, everyone gets breaks, but champions capitalize on them. And I think that's really true for those who make it in golf and those who don't. And that's true in life as well. I think we all will have opportunities come our way. And whether or not we capitalize them is up to us. And that doesn't mean that, you know, we're forever a failure if we don't. Like, I didn't capitalize on some of the chances I got, but it does shape the trajectory and it does inform our steps forward. So it was a fascinating journey, and I'm really grateful for the opportunity, but it didn't end how I thought it would.
Right. Okay. So first of all, everything you're describing is what I have heard from friends who have played on the tour too. It's just not starting off. I mean, I'm not picking on anybody, but it's not Phil Mickelson getting in the private jet, flying to the next location mm-hmm. when you're starting off. And frankly, Dane, I don't think it's that way for a lot of golfers, period, ever, mm-hmm. right?
I was just going to say, you know, the 1% of the 1% is what everyone knows, right? The 1% of the 1% means the 1% out of the professional golfers that are the Jordan Spieths, that are the Phil Mickelsons, that are the Tiger Woods, right? The ones that everyone know about, they're the ones that have the early breaks, the early opportunities, and they capitalized on them and kept building on that momentum. The majority of people, that doesn't happen. And so we look at the ideal picture in the ideal environment and say that would be an amazing reality. But even that isn't as ideal as we think it is, right? They still sacrifice a ton to do what they do and to be at the level that they're at. And it looks different, obviously, than the road for most people in that position. But you're right. Like, it's not glamorous. It's not like a celebrity script in that sense.
But the pressure is real, Thane. I mean, the mm-hmm. the pressure is real. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're putting to win the Masters or if you're putting to make the cut and pick up some money mm-hmm. to pay for next week's rent. The pressure is real.
Yep. And that's a good point you make, that the experience is the same, even in different versions of that experience. So like you said, the version of that experience to make a putt to win the Masters, they're going to feel the same thing that lower level professional guys like myself at the time would feel on a putt to make the cut that would give them status for maybe the next week's event, or a putt to get in the top 10 that again would get them into the next week's event, or even more so, a lot, you know, the way that guys get to the PGA Tour is through the Korn Ferry Tour. The way that you get on the Korn Ferry Tour is through Q School primarily. And that is a series of four separate tournaments that cost anywhere from $5 to $7,500. And there is no monetary gain. There's only status gain. So you're paying close to $7,500 for the chance to play in possibly four tournaments that could get you status. And if you fail to qualify at any stage, you're out of the money and you're out of the opportunity. And so that is really the peak of pressure for a lot of guys, because it's a win or go home scenario every year, once a year.
And so I'm laying this foundation because I really want to get into what you're doing now, but there's so much that I'm guessing had to have shaped your thought process and even how you're approaching things now. I want to get to just the wisdom and the experience that you have. But the reason I'm laying this foundation is because I can imagine that there are some people going, wait a minute, Thane, how old are you? Wait, you're coaching what? I think there's a real opportunity mm-hmm. to learn from people who are not like you and who have gone through an experience you've gone through. I don't care what age they are, because I can't help but wonder, as you began to say, okay, it's not the tour. And if I'm not mistaken, part of that was because of a nagging injury that it just wasn't going away. I found with people who are in professional sports that some of the stuff that you find in other people's lives later gets sort of telescoped into an earlier part of your life, like an injury, like a nagging pain that doesn't go away. And you're dealing with a kind of a transition into, like, you know, next job, next life, next identity, next whatever, the way somebody who maybe 2, 3, 4 decades later would be dealing with. But I'd love for you, that was an awful lot there. I just want to put some stuff on the table and say, talk to us about that. Because I think as a guy who is in his late 20s, I think, or is that right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You've got life experience that informs and shapes how you've navigated that. Was that injury that big of a deal? I mean, did I read that correctly? Was that a part of the decision?
Definitely. Yeah. A lot there to unpack, and we'll get to some of it here. You know, I think the first thing to say is that I by no means want to project or portray someone who doesn't factor in age either. I totally understand, you know, that being 29 is what I am. There's a lot of things I haven't experienced in life. And I also understand there's a lot of things I have experienced in life. And so that was, you know, the first book I wrote is called From Here to There, and it's a quarter life perspective on the path to mastery. And really what the goal for this book when I first wrote it was to provide a thank you to the investors and sponsors that backed me in my professional golf journey. When I was facing this injury and not sure whether I would be able to keep competing, I wanted a way to give them something in return for their investment. If it wasn't the financial gain, what could I do as a way to say thanks? And that was the original impetus for the book. And then as I wrote it over those 18 months or whatever, it turned into something a little different than I originally intended. It was more a book about pursuing excellence in any field based on my experiences thus far and in golf. And it was really interesting to see how that took shape. But my grandpa, I still remember, he gave me this advice. He said, "Thane, you're trying to write a book about a marathon from mile 9. I don't think that's very wise." And he had a really good point, you know, and I definitely hear that. And my follow-up or response to that is, I agree, and yet learning from those that are on mile 9 helps us understand the overall journey just as well as someone who's finished it, because they're speaking to the journey from the journey. And for other people who are on mile 9, that's going to be really helpful. And maybe for people that are mile 18 that need to remember some of the things they learned on mile 9, will be reminded and encouraged by that as well. So that was kind of what shaped even the book, but it shapes a lot of my work now of just saying, look, I will grant that I don't have the experience that comes with age of someone at 50, but I will also caveat that by saying I was blessed with the opportunity to dive deep into self-awareness to a level that I never would have if I hadn't pursued professional golf, if I hadn't been given that opportunity. And the fruit from that allows me to have an experience that can assist others in that process and to come alongside them in their own performance, in their own development, in their own self-awareness and self-leadership in life. And that's what I'm most passionate about. So you're right, the injury played a huge part in that transition. It was a back strain 5 times, it repeated over a year and a half. And that was one of the things that God used. I think God knew that I'm pretty stubborn, I'm uber competitive. And if he didn't provide a force of my hand, then I may have stuck with it for longer than I should have. I don't know. But it definitely was a big factor.
So we're shifting now. I'm just trying to follow the trajectory of your life. So you're moving now out of professional golf. You've written this book. You know, a word that I use, Thane, I don't know if you're comfortable with it, is calling. So there's a nudge, there's a calling towards, okay, here's the next part of my life. Here's how I'm going to find meaning in this next season of my life. Talk to us a little bit more about what that's like, making the shift from, this is kind of my identity, this is what I wrapped my life around since you were a kid, and now there's this other thing. Is loss a part of what you're sensing mm-hmm. at some point?
Yeah, no doubt. I think it's a really fitting word and idea. You definitely lose a piece of your identity, but really what it is a discovery that that's not your true identity. Exactly. I think that's what's so beautiful about it. It's a death and rebirth in a greater renewal, right? Of what is truly there beneath the surface that we were misguided into thinking. I'm really grateful for that because it has provided a huge blessing for me to take forward in my journey post golf, because now I get to practice that over and over again, that my identity isn't found in my worth or value from a bank account. My identity and worth isn't found in the job title or the successes or these things behind the name. My identity isn't found in any of that. It's just in who I am as a human being and who God's called me to be. And so I think that calling is really important. You know, one of the things I sat with as I was considering whether it was golf or something else, I took a few months to really sit with it and try to discern, like, man, what do I do here? And the question that came front of mind in that process was, who have I been created, equipped, and called to be? And I think there's a beauty to this question that I love sharing, because you know, it speaks to three different levels. Created is that natural gifting or wiring that we've kind of gotten from birth. Equipped is, what are those life experiences given you up to this point? How has that shaped you? How has that uniquely gifted you to bring that gift to the world? And then called is that passion, that fire that just won't die in you, that you feel driven to do something, compelled to do something that's unique to you almost in that. So that question was really monumental for me in making that transition well and really pivoting to a path that wasn't necessarily conventional, right? Like, it wasn't a conventional path. And most of what I've done in life has not been conventional. And so to do that, I had to have a strong conviction. And that question helped create and shape that conviction that led me on the journey since.
Yeah, well, I love the fact that you're not shying away from the fact that there's this calling and this meaning and significance. I would even say significance to what it is that you're doing now and what you feel compelled to do now. I just want to affirm that. You know, I'm going to sound like a pastor, so here's a pastor alert. I give these every now and then. But for me, Jeremiah, the prophet Jeremiah, and I have spent a lot of time together, and I love it when God's calling him and his first real response back, excuse back, is, I'm way too young for this. And there's a translation of the Bible called The Voice, and I love the take on this where God is saying to Jeremiah, and I think the quote is, don't use your youth as an excuse. Mm. I'm the one that called you. Mm-hmm. I'm the one that equipped you. I'm the one that's going to be with you. And that's exactly what you're describing. But do you see, hear what I hear with people of your age? And I'm going to go on ahead and say young men in particular, young millennials who are, there's this thing out there, well, I got to make my million or my billion by the time I'm 30. Mm. And there's so much pressure from social media, from books, from just like the narrative itself, the story out there. Is that true? And if so, what do you say to that? How do you push against that as a guy who's in his late 20s? How does that work?
Yeah, no, that's really powerful. And I think it ties into the consumeristic culture we live in. I think it ties into the technological age that we're faced with and the mounting pressures of comparison and how interconnected we all are and how we always see the winning stories. There's a lot of factors here, but you're 100% right that there is a mounting pressure that people are faced in this time and in this generation. You know, a couple things I think we've lost. One is we've lost vision for the long game. We've lost the idea of legacy and how we can create compounding generational impact. And it's something that, you know, I am with my fellow millennials in that. It's hard, right? It's not the language, it's not the messaging that we hear and see and that we are drawn to. I was actually really reminded of this last year. My grandparents on my mom's side passed away. And just being at their, you know, memorial services and celebrating their lives was a powerful experience for me to be like, man, the impact that these two individuals had that passed along now three generations and beyond is special. And that's what I want to build into, not some, you know, social media following, not some X, Y, or Z that's temporal, that's short term, that won't give what it promises. And so I think those types of reminders are what we really need. And we're not going to get those in the virtual space. We're not going to get those online. We're not going to get those from best-selling books a lot of the times. It's the reminder that there's a quote, I think Bill Gates or one of those guys said that we all overestimate what can be accomplished in 1 year and underestimate what can be accomplished in 10. And that's something I preach to myself a lot. Because it's easy to get caught up in the hustle and say, man, I just need to work harder. I need to hustle harder. I really need to capitalize on these really productive years. So like you said, I can make my millions or billions by 30 and I can be the success that these other people are.
So I guess what I'd be curious to hear is when you're saying, you said something about, we don't hear that as a generation, some of this idea of the potential for really a legacy for generational change. Mm-hmm. As the oldest guy in the room, what would you say, like, how can people who are further down the line, how do we speak into and breathe into what you're describing, what you're aspiring to? Because what I'm curious about, Thane, is how do we continue to build bridges? And what do these connections look like between a 20-something and a 50-something, a 30-something and a 60-something? What would you say to people like, hey, this would help the millennials in your life? Come on, here's your chance. Mm-hmm. Preach.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's, I don't have the answer or the authority on this, I'll just caveat by that. But I will say, you know, some things from my perspective are, I think one is, the way we really make an impact, I think, on anyone, regardless of the generation, is by unconditional love and by giving that usually in a human way. So in person, one-on-one, right? And so, like, if we think about how you or I have been transformed, how we've changed, like, from the inside out, it's through unconditional love. It's through God's literally unconditional love. And we get to practice that now in marriage. I get to do that with my wife. And we talk about it all the time, like, the only thing that transforms us is truly that. And so when I think about how you make that bridge between generations, I think it's this this idea of accepting as you are. It's saying, yeah, I think I love the quote. Actually, Richard Rohr said, love is saying yes to what is. And that's just a great way to frame it, of saying, like, you know, it's accepting what is, the reality that we face right now, with whoever it is you're interacting with. So I think that's step one. And step two is living out of health in that place. So for the people that are in the older generation, speaking of the younger, you need to be displaying a life of health and abundance in your life that can be an example to them as you live alongside them, right? And that's true for me or anyone else, right? If I'm trying to work with people on performance and yet I'm living a really unhealthy life and I'm not in my best place, I'm not going to provide very much value there. So there's an accountability on that. And then the other is, I think it's just those constant reminders along the way. And I think your podcast, like this conversation right here, is an important piece of that. It's from the messaging and the pulpit even. It's from how we interact with people in our daily lives. I don't think there is a simple answer or solution or a one-stop shop, right? But I think the combination of those things starts changing the narrative. And I think it has to be done in person, in a human interaction and a relational way, because we all have experienced how lacking social or virtual connections can be. And COVID, I think, has highlighted that even more so. And there's a real thirst, I would say, for that interaction on a human level that really creates meaningful change or meaningful impact in people's lives.
So one of the things that that I think we have in common is that there's even, I think you even have something that you, in some of your, it might be in one of your books, but this idea that you just don't want people to settle. Let's not settle. And I feel like that's, sometimes people will discount that as, you know, rah-rah, self-help, go get them, you know, coach stuff. But I really do believe that, again, from my perspective, my worldview, that God has created us, but he's created us to get stuff done in this world, and we're made in his image. And so this is how I live the best life that Jesus has called me to live. But in that, I'm going to fail. And you talk about the fruits of failure. And I love the fact that a guy who is saying, no, never settle, let's do this, let's work towards this. There is, you do have potential to make a difference. Oh yeah. But there's also a kind of fruit in my failure. You don't often hear that with certain people who spend a lot of time talking about potential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the simplest way to say is we always learn what not to do before we learn what to do. And that means we fall down before we learn how to walk while standing up, right? Especially as kids, as we're growing. So there is inevitably a fruit from failure. The caveat, the key is, did we take the time to learn what that fruit is after the fact? You know, because a lot of times we repeat failures over and over again. And a lot of the problem with that is, we aren't taking the time to really process and understand why, what happened. And that's where, you know, I loved when I looked into a little bit more of getting familiar with your stuff. And I love seeing your book on Never Settle. Like, it made me jealous. I'm like, I wish I had that book, because I love that phrase. You know, it's like my favorite, you know, my rally cry or mantra has been take ownership and never settle, because I think those two are the keys to living a intentional successful life, a life of integrity. And that never settle part is really, it ties to discipline, I think, ultimately at its core. And the way I like to think about discipline is it's intention plus effort. And I guess the way I describe it is saying that, you know, similar to the natural flow of, gosh, second law of thermodynamics is entropy, right? And entropy is that all things without effort or energy decay. And the same is true, I think, in life, right? If we don't make an intentional choice, we're going to be going down the escalator. It's a downward going escalator, right?
Brother, let me tell you, when you get older, that whole law comes into full view. So yes, that's right.
Yes. And so even say like down the stream, right? And so we're all going downstream without making any choice. That's our default. So to go upstream, we have to choose. We have to have an intention. We have to say, I want to go upstream. That's the choice. And then we have to start rowing to start moving upstream, right? There has to be an effort or else we're not going to move upstream. And so I think that's really what discipline is saying, I'm not going to default to settling. I'm not going to default to status quo. I'm not going to default to the path of least resistance. I'm going to choose to go down this path with intention and backing it up by my actions and my effort, because I believe and I know that's what's best, at least for this next step.
Yeah. Yeah. That intentionality is so key, because so much of life isn't going to just happen. I mean, we're called to pursue it. We're called to this one thing I do. One writer in the New Testament says, so there's an intentionality to it that is, I don't know, I think it's important, but are you hearing things trending one way or the other on this as we're trying to come out of this pandemic? I mean, what are you hearing?
Yeah, I think it's a mixed bag, but I think as a whole, you know, there's this kind of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps in a sense, once we have got things more back to normal, quote unquote, the new normal, whatever that is. I think there's a kind of a doubling down on efforts to get back up to full speed. And I think a lot of people feel overloaded and overburdened. And so, simply put, I think there's a lot of noise. And when there's a lot of noise, it's really hard to have clear intentions, because we're bombarded on all fronts by job responsibilities, expectations and demands, uncomfortability with things that we used to be comfortable with. It's getting reused to social dynamics and interacting and relationships. I mean, my wife and I felt that. It's like, oh, we're hanging out with a group of people now. Like, how do we do this again? You know? So there's a whole almost readjusting that's taking place. So I think you're right. I think there is more challenge to having intentionality in what we do, having intentionality in our human interactions, having intentionality with how we structure and plan our days, how we do our work. I think there does need to be consciousness around that. It will be an adjusting period. Like, it's not just turn the light switch off on and we're back to normal. There's a period of readjustment that I think we're all going through. And intentionality doesn't happen by chance either. So that having that front of mind is going to be important, and is important even for me personally. It takes more effort for me to go into social settings with intention than it used to, because of that adjustment period. So telling myself, preaching that to myself when I'm going into a meeting or being around other people, like, how can I see and love and care for this person or this group? And have that intentionality. I have to be more proactive in infusing that.
Well, for me, one of the things I'm also trying to tell myself is to just be open to some, I don't know, different ways to do things. This is a perfect chance for each of us in a variety of ways to rethink some things. I'm not saying we reinvent everything, but I'm trying to stay open. I don't know, what's a good word? Curious. I'm trying to stay interested in, okay, maybe there's a different way to do this. Maybe I can come at this differently than I did before.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear how, even just to throw it back your way, how have you found, what ways have you found to do that well? Because that is something I think that I want to do well too. And I think anyone listening would be like, yeah, I want to be more curious or open to change. But what's helpful for you in that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm the one doing the interview, so don't be doing that.
Hot seat. Yeah.
No, I would say this. I there's three words I try to practice saying out loud in conversations with people. And I think part of it is it just helps me. But these three words are, I don't know. So somebody will ask something, I go, I don't know. We should probably, what do you think? Let's try that. There's a really interesting book by Adam Grant. I don't know if you've read his book, Think Again. But it's a great book about just what it sounds like, thinking again. He's got some, you know, some really interesting stories and research, and it's that kind of a book. But he talks about, and I'm going to paraphrase this, but I think I'll get it right. He talks about when you're learning something, maybe you're becoming an expert in something. There's like this graph and you can see, you know, it's a pretty steep graph and oh boy, I'm learning an awful lot. And he said, you get to this place on the graph where you think you've got it figured out. You've now learned a little bit about football and you could probably coach an NFL team. You've got this dialed in. And he said, if you stop there, then you won't get to the rest of it, which is, and then the graph starts going downhill. And he said, you push in deeper and you start to learn, oh my, now I know what I don't know, what I don't know, what I don't know. And then the graph starts picking up again. And I'm going to get this quote wrong, but his basic point in this part of one of these chapters is, he calls the top of that first mountain where you don't know what he calls that Mount Stupid. And he says, don't get stranded on top of Mount Stupid. And what I find in my life, Thane, is that I'm embarrassed how many times I've gotten stranded at the top of Mount Stupid. And so if I can remember that and just keep saying, I don't know, and you ask these curious questions, that's a start for me, is to just ask curious questions of somebody and say, okay, well, wait a minute. Tell me how you came to that conclusion. What is that? Or what do I need to know that you don't know? Tell me about that. And I'm making that sound like I'm Mr., you know, humble, whatever, but I'm telling you, it serves you well when you say, I don't want to get stranded at the top of that Mount Stupid, because I've been there too many times. And so I don't know if that answered your question or not. Like I said, I'm the one that's supposed to be asking these questions, but.
It's really good. No, I love that insight. I was going to say that, you know, it reminds me that we all operate in a sense out of self-preservation. Like we want to preserve our own intellect or our own image or our own identity. Yet just laying that down and being honest, open, and vulnerable to what, you know, the other person is saying is such a superpower, you know, like you said. And I think, you know, I experience it probably most with my wife, because that's the relationship, you know, I'm only a couple of years in now, but it's a relationship where it's the most difficult to be curious in, because we're around each other all the time. We know each other better than anyone else, you know, on the planet. It's one of those relationships where it's easy to slide back into the automatic operating system that I already know this person. I know what they're thinking. I know what the, and we lose all curiosity. We lose all openness. We lose, I lose the ability to ask clarifying questions because I'm assuming, and that's the practice for me right now, but it is such a practice, you know, it's a challenge.
I think your other book was called A Catalyst for Hope. Is that right? And I love the idea of both of those words, the idea of being a catalyst and this hope, again, as the Apostle Paul would put it, it is a hope that does not disappoint. There is a kind of hope that will not let you down. And I love that you are a young man who's stepping out there. People talk about midlife crisis. You had a quarter life, not crisis, but you had a moment where you had to transition to a different world, a different life, a different everything. And I want to affirm you on that. And I just thank you for this. If we could, I'd love to just do what we have been doing with people just to kind of have fun. I've got some and one questions, but before that, we ask our guests if we could, and of course there is no physical award and we don't have an award ceremony, but we love to give out way to go awards. And so I just want, Thane, for you, like, who would you nominate for a way to go award? It's somebody who is getting it done in your world, in the world. Who are you nominating?
Way to go, Ward. You know, I think recency bias always prevails in this. So there's a lot of people that I could thank or nominate or honor or appreciate in this time. And I am who I am largely because of the impact of those people in my life. So, you know, I wish I could list them all. Well, I'll stick with one right now. And that's my pastor, our pastor here in Denver, Rob Brendel. You know, we have really felt at home at our church, Denver United here. And, you know, I've been in quite a few churches, been in church my whole life, and I'm just really grateful for the space that they hold. They're called Denver United for a reason. They're really focused on creating unity. That is one of the hardest things to do, period. It's not uniformity. They're very different. A lot of churches are great at uniformity. Very few are good at unity. And to actually wade into that and to not be afraid of that and to hold this tension in the space for that in a church setting. I mean, I don't envy them for trying to do that, but man, I've been so grateful and humbled to be a part of what they're trying to do there and what they are doing there.
That's cool. That's cool. You may have, now we've got these and one questions. You may have just answered this first one, but who's the one person that's made a lasting impact on your life? Here's where maybe, you know, we'll open it up for you again.
Yeah. I'll go for someone else. You know, I mean, I'd be remiss to say my parents, you know, like my dad and my mom have definitely done that. And so that would be, you know, the first for sure. Gimme. Layup, but I think I'd come back to Jamie Winship. And Jamie Winship's a guy who really walks by faith. And for me, I come from a much more reformed or theological background that's pretty truth heavy, very heady. And to really learn from him on what engaging and depending on the Spirit can look like. And what God can do through that dependence it's been really powerful. And so I think, especially in the last handful of years, that's been one of the, even from afar, you know, I've actually never met him in person. We've exchanged some calls and we have a friendship now, but from afar, he's really made a sizable impact.
That's cool. That's cool. What's one thing you're loving these days that we should check out? And this is wide open. This could be something you're watching, you're streaming. It could be something you read, music. What's one thing you're loving these days that we should check out?
You know, one of the things I really loved was, I'll give two because I can't give one. I'm a creative, so I just kind of all over. One will be a book, one will be a podcast. Book, The Evolving Self. If you like kind of diving in the weeds of psychology, how we're wired, development as humans, I can't recommend enough. It was by Robert Keegan in the 70s. And it just does a great job of breaking down how we develop as humans and this spiral that we're on. It's kind of tied to, I think he's probably the original founder of spiral dynamics. If people know that, it's kind of in the weeds as well. But this idea that we go on this spiral upwards in a helix throughout our lives and through our development that is between autonomy and independence and community and inclusion. And so we're even if you look, he breaks it down from, you know, birth to adulthood, basically. And you see this so much, especially if you're a parent. I'm sure I'm not yet, but I can imagine if I had kids, how much I would have seen what he's saying in their own development. So I think that's a really fun resource for those that are curious and interested. And then the podcast would be a recent one by Christianity Today, The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. I think people have probably heard of it, but man, I was really impressed with the quality of production. They did a top-notch job, and I thought it was really fair. You know, they tried to hold that space of that middle ground of just conveying the information, sharing sides of the story, and providing some cautionary tales of how we can abuse power or how it can be for people in the Christian world. I think it's a really helpful thing to listen to give us more resources to just try to be the healthiest, best version that we can.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, that's great. That's great. What's one way you're connecting with God these days?
You know, like I said, my background is very knowledge heavy. And so the thing that for me that I felt I really need the most in probably the last handful of years is less information or knowledge and more presence and being with God. And so I think the thing that's been most helpful for me is not having a strict routine on my time with God, not having it be like in the Bible every day, even though I do pretty much read the Bible every day, more focused on the contemplative side of spirituality. How can I really be in the presence of God? How can I really tune in? How can I listen? So I think listening prayer is one of the best and greatest blessings for me and my wife, even as we build and grow our relationship with God, of just asking and sitting and listening and being, okay, God, what do you have for us in this? And just being in that space and not expecting an audible voice or a profound this or that, just expecting him to move. And that looks like a lot of different things. And you know, we even have taken that into the community group we lead, and we do a time of just quiet space before every session of 5 minutes in a group of, you know, 10 to 20 people, just sitting there with a little background music and quietness. It can be a really profound space. So that's been the biggest impact.
What's one lesson you wish you would have learned sooner?
The lesson of integrity. The lesson that integrity, as I define it, and I think others have, is wholeness, of being whole, of having, you know, in a sense, your conscious and your subconscious mind in alignment, meaning who you say you are is who you live out in daily life. I wish I would have learned the importance of that earlier. I lived a life with a lack of integrity for, gosh, 7+ years, and caused a lot of pain for myself, for others, a lot of regrets, you know, a lot of things that still sadden me to this day. I'm grateful God's used it to make me who I am, but if I could have learned the importance and lesson of integrity sooner, and how important that is to living a healthy, joy-filled life, it would have been a blessing to me and others.
Well, thank you for that honesty. What's one trait that you had as a kid growing up that you still have?
I think it's the competitiveness and the discipline. You know, it's something that it's always there, and sometimes to a fault, a degree. I hate losing at anything. My wife can attest to that. And so it drives me to be more disciplined a lot of times because I'm so competitive. And so that competitive nature has never left, and I probably won't my whole life. So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. One last question. What's one way you're moving into this next year, this next season, with hope?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think the underlying theme of that for me would be the power of influence and the power of unconditional love in liberating others. And it happens on a daily, momentary, person-by-person basis. So the amount of impact that you can have on one person in one moment just by seeing them, hearing them, recognizing them, or understanding them and connecting them to something greater is so profound. And I think the hope that I want to more consistently live into is to have the intention of, man, I can transform someone's life by simply seeing, hearing, or connecting them to something greater. And that can happen every single day if I'm just open, right? Like we talked about, if I'm open to it, if I'm seeing with God's eyes, if I'm hearing with his ears, if I'm actually looking and not stuck on my priorities or my tasks or my all important to-dos, which we all know aren't. So
that's good, man. That's good. Thank you for sharing that. Thank you for what you're doing. Thanks for taking time out to be with us. We're going to let folks know in the show notes about your books and your website and courses and just your life now of encouraging others to essentially live their best life. They've been called to something now and now pursue that. And so, Thane, I just love your voice. I love the fact that you're speaking not just to millennials, but really to all of us. So thank you for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Greg. Yeah. And I love that we share the affinity for never settling. So we are companions in that. And I love that you're forwarding that mission as well. And it's a great space to do it. So excited to see how you continue to bless others through it.
Thanks for listening to a Godzillion in One podcast. subscribe, share this episode with a friend, and head over to gregholder.com for the show notes. And as always, stop and notice this week the shockingly and seemingly endless ways to connect with each other, this world, and the God who made it all. We'll see you next time.